This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
Good evening. We're going to start with the fourth day, which you'll find in verse 14, Pasuk Yud Aleph, which is on page 4 of the printed handout. Let's read through the what it says, and then we'll start opening it up. Vayomer Elohim, and God said, Yehi me'oros b'rkiya ha'shamayim, let there be light in the heavens and the skies, lahavdil ben hayom v'ein ha'loilo, to distinguish between the day and the night, v'hoyu lo etzoysu l'mo'adim v'l'yomim v'shonim, and they will be for signs, for Yom Tov, the six times of Yom Tov, fix the days and the years, the calendars, and they will be for lights in the sky, to give light to the land. Rashi points out, if you look in the beginning of Pasuk Yud Aleph in the Rashi, Miyom Rishon Nivru. Rashi says these lights were created on the first day. On the fourth day, God suspended them. That they, the material of the lights, the sun, the moon, the stars, were all created on the first day and put into position on the fourth day. And Rashi continued to say, and so all the generations, everything that was generated by heaven and earth, were created on the first day. V'kol echot v'echot nikba b'yom shenigzar olov, and each item was simply put in place on the specific day that's mentioned. So Rashi here goes along a similar line to what we noticed in the Ramban weeks ago, and that was that the creation took place only on the first day. There was no creation after the first day. The word boro doesn't appear again until later on, but so far we haven't had the word boro. It says in the beginning God created heaven and earth, and thereafter God said this and God said this and God said this, but it doesn't say he created anything. The meaning, says Rashi here and others, and the Ramban we saw, was that whatever was created on the first day and then evolved, was put into place, however we want to understand it, clearly with God's guidance and with God's intent, but there was no act of creation. Everything came from what was created on the first day. Hushikasuv, and that's what it means in the first day. Rashi here explains the very first verse of the Torah. And he says that is what is meant when it says in the beginning God created Es HaShomayim, the heaven. L'Rabu is told the same. That means the heaven and everything that was going to be produced out of the heaven. The Es HaOretz and the land, L'Rabu is told the same, and the land, earth, and everything that would be produced out of earth was created on the first day. So again, the creation took place only on the first day. And it's interesting that we get into such a tumult with the evolution and non-evolution. As we said before, of course there was evolution. It's quite clear that there was evolution. The question is just whether God was involved in the evolution or not. The seculars say it all just happened. And we say it was God evolved it, God developed it, but it grew. It was like a plant that put a flower in the ground, a seed in the ground, and there it grows by itself. It's programmed from the beginning to grow in a particular way. So here, on each day, there's a statement of God. God says something. God adds something to the creation each day. But what he adds is an instruction. What he adds is not a new creation. What was created on the first day. Other than the specific cases that we'll still see, nothing else was created after the first day. Everything else was drawn out, was pulled out. There were generations. It was as if it had children. It regenerated itself, the soul split and the soul expanded, and who knows how it happened and what the scientific process was, but it did all come from one small germ that was created on the first day, one small seed, whether it was that hydrogen atom that we talked about or whatever it was that was created on the first day down here, and likewise something for heaven, that little seed for heaven and that little seed for earth, those were two different ones. It wasn't one seed that was created for both. Heaven and earth don't come from the same place, other than from God, obviously. But there was a seed for heaven, there was a seed for earth, there was a seed for the spiritual, there was a seed for the material. And everything material generated from that seed, and everything spiritual generated from the spiritual seed. The bridge between the spiritual and the physical is going to be the human being. Apart from that, there is no connection, or no meaningful connection. It's the human being that manages the relationship and the connection between those two worlds. But the worlds were created then, including the luminaries, the lights. The Ramban says that we know that there was light before this, because God created light and darkness on the first day. God said, let there be light, and he divided between the light and the darkness, and there was evening and there was morning. So before there was the sun and the moon, there was light and there was darkness. And the Ramban says God took that light, which was light that was, whose source was not a physical object, but that light was much more spiritual. And we talked about that and how wisdom translated into energy and so on. So that energy did not have a physical source. It wasn't a burning fire. It was pure, raw energy. And God created it like a backwards evolution almost. God turned the energy into matter, in the case of the sun into gas, and in the case of the moon into a solid. Now we're going to see tonight that the moon wasn't a solid from the very beginning. But what is clear is, let's start off with two luminaries, the two lights, and let's assume for a moment that they were both gaseous to start. So God turns energy into gas. And again, had we said this 100 years ago, it would have been absurd. People would have said, come on, you don't really believe that, do you? Of course, since Einstein, we know that that's absolutely possible. No problem with that. You can take energy, this is, you can take matter and turn it into energy. So you can take energy and turn it into matter. And God did just that. He started with energy. The energy came from him. And at this point, according to Ramban, he takes that pure energy and he compresses the energy into matter. The matter that he compresses it into is the gas of the sun. And let us assume for a moment that the moon was created in the same way. So the Torah goes on to say, Vayas Elohim, in verse 16, and God made the two major lights, the one major light, the greater major light to rule over the day, and the minor light to rule over the night, and the stars, which is a strange formation. It should really say the big star, big light to rule over the day, and the little light and the stars to rule over the night. But it doesn't say that. It says, and the little star and the little light to rule over the night, the Esek Echotim and the stars. Like almost some kind of afterthought. The word Es can also mean with. So the English translates it here, and God made it in, and the stars. But the it can also be translated, bear that in mind, we'll understand that in a medrash in a little while. The Esek Echovim could be with the stars, created the moon with the stars. Vayitenu Esom Elokim Berkei HaShemayim, God positioned them in the heavens, L'ho'ira L'oretz, to give light to the earth. The Limshol Bayom of Alayla, and to rule over the day and the night, U'lavdil Bein Ha'or V'Bein HaChoshech, and to differentiate between the night, the light and the dark. Vayar Elokim Ki Tov, and God saw that it was good. It was evening, good morning, it was the fourth day. Now let's look at some of the midrashic material. What concerns the Gemara, the Gemara in Chulin and Daf Tanach, is the inconsistency that's very obvious, it's quite jarring, in verse 16, and that is, and God made the two big lights, he made the big light to rule over the day, and the little light to rule over the night. He should say he made the one big light to rule over the day and the other big light to rule over the night. Or he should say he made the two lights, the bigger one and the smaller one. The bigger one for the night, the smaller one for the day. The Tzaddik says he made two big lights, the bigger one for this and the smaller one for that. And the Gemara takes from that, and so does the Medrash, and so does the Zohar, that there was obvious, there was something changed in that person. There was an intention to have two equal lights, and then there was some change, and there was a bigger light and a smaller light. And the Gemara gives us the background. The Gemara says the following. Rabbi Shimon ben Pazi Rami. Rabbi Shimon ben Pazi threw these two statements together. He posed a contradiction. Ksivit says, Vayata l'kim eshnei amoris ha-gedolim. God made the two large lights. Ksivit, it says, this amor ha-gedol, this amor ha-kotan. He made the large one and he made the small one. What's that all about? He explains the background. Omro yoreach lifnei ha-kodesh baruch hu, in an allegorical sense. The moon said to God, can you have two kings sharing one crown? Any manager knows that you've got to put one person in charge of a project. You can't put two people in charge of a project. If you put two people in charge of a project, nobody's in charge of the project. It doesn't happen. It doesn't get done. You've got to have one person. So you can't have a sun and a moon. You can't have two bright lights up in the sky. It won't work. Amalah says, God, you know, you're right. The Chil Mati is actually. So go and reduce your size. You're right, there can't be a too big one. So you moon, make yourself small. Is it right that because I said to you something which you agree with, I pointed out to you a flaw in your management philosophy, and you accepted it, you agreed with it. Is it right that I should be made to make myself smaller? Omalo, he said to her, okay, says God, as compensation for being the smaller one, you can exist both in the day and the night. Sometimes you can see the moon in the daytime. You can never see the sun in the nighttime. But you can see the moon in the daytime. So I'm giving you more territory. You're smaller, but you extend over a greater territory. What's the good of a candle at midday? Says the moon. What am I going to be able to contribute to the world when the sun is there? Thank you. You give me more territory, but you give me more territory when I'm eclipsed by the sun. Oh, and God says, okay, I'll give you something else. Zil limnu bach Yisrael yomim b'shoni. We'll use you for the Jewish calendar. How about that? We won't use the sun. We'll make a Jewish calendar that will be governed by the moon, not by the sun. So, although you're smaller, you're going to have greater importance. Omrona, she says to him, the moon says, yomenami yevshad lo'emanu beit kufta. Don't pull the wool over my eyes. You're going to use the sun as well. Because although you're going to, the Jewish year is governed by the moon, the months are governed by the moon, but the lunar calendar has to be brought into sync with the solar calendar. And you have to make leap years, and there are all sorts of tekufos. The solar system plays an important part in our calendar too. So don't tell me the calendar is going to be mine. We're going to be sharing the calendar. We're sharing day and night. Everything we're sharing. And now I'm smaller because I pointed out to you that was a bad management philosophy. God says, all right, well, I'll tell you this then. Zil likru tzadiku bishmech. Your smallness will become a quality that tzadikim, righteous people, will admire. Yaakov HaKotan, people will call the Yaakov HaKotan, the small Yaakov, Shmuel HaKotan, David HaKotan. The concept of katnus, of smallness, will be an admirable quality that the great righteous people of the world will adopt. And that will be an honor of you. You'll be honored in that way. Chazye deloi kam Yisrael. God saw that the moon wasn't having any of it. The moon was still upset, the moon was still sad, and nothing that God gave the moon in compensation satisfied the moon. Omar HaKadosh Baruch Hu Aviyu Kaporo Alai. So God said, bring an atonement for me, Al Shimi Atzias HaYoreach, that I caused the moon to become small. V'haylu D'Omar Rabbi Shimon Ben Lakish, and that's what Rabbi Shimon Lakish explains. Ma Nishtaneh Se'ir Shorosh Chodesh Hashem. And all the Yom Tovs, we just finished a whole series of Yom Tovs. Whenever there's a Yom Tov, it says Seir Lechatos. In addition to the sacrifices of the day, you bring a Seir, a goat, Lechatos as a sin offering. On Rosh Chodesh, it says slightly differently. It says Seir Chatos LaHashem. You bring a sin offering for God. So normally we translate that as to God. You bring a sin offering to God. But if that's what it means, then it should say that with all the Yom Tov, all our offerings unto God. So whenever it sits in offering, it should say LaHashem, LaHashem, LaHashem. But it doesn't. It only says it on Rosh Chodesh, on the new moon. Omar Kodesh Boruch explains Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish, Se'il zeh yehei kapora al shem yatzir tayoreh. The goat that the Jewish people bring every Rosh Chodesh is a sacrifice, a sin offering, not for their sin, but for my sin, says God. Incredible concept. Isn't it an amazing concept? That that our God sins, so to say. God, that sin is something that is so... It becomes elevated. That not only... It's not a function of human failing. This gives us a new look at sin, and we'll discuss that in a moment. God sins too. How is that possible? God is the authority. How can he sin? Who's he sinning against? And he brings us a kapora every month for the last 4,500 years. Every month we're supposed to bring a korban, and we say it in our musaf. Although we don't bring the sacrifice now, we recite it every Rosh Chodesh. It's an offering for Hashem. Every month he brings a sin offering because he reduced the moon. Now that's difficult to understand altogether. Firstly, not really he who reduced the moon. The moon was the one who started complaining. The moon would have kept quiet. God wouldn't have reduced the moon. Why did the God reduce the moon? Because the moon wouldn't share. The moon wouldn't play the game. You don't want to share, then it becomes a second. It becomes smaller. Secondly, what is God responsible for? What did God actually do? Now the same story is told in the Medrash slightly differently. But the difference is very important. Let me read you the Medrash. They ask the same question. Why are they first called the two big lights and then the small light and the big light? It was because it encroached on the territory of its friend. The moon encroached on the sun's territory. Amar Rabbi Pinchas. Rabbi Pinchas says the same thing. With all the sacrifices, it says a goat. From Rosh Chodesh, it says a goat shall be brought as a sin offering to Hashem. Amar HaKadosh Baruch Hu, God said, Haviu kaporo alai, bring an atonement for me, Shemiatati et hayoreach, because I caused the moon to become small. Why? What did I do wrong? The Medrash tells us what God did wrong. I caused the moon to encroach on the territory of the sun. I did that. I set them up for it. I could have kept them separate, but I didn't. I caused the moon to encroach on the territory of the sun. And therefore, it was inevitable that the moon would complain. I instigated the moon's complaint. And I had to respond the way I did. I had to reduce the size of the moon. So in essence, it was I who did it all. I can't really blame it on the moon. The moon suffers because it chose to complain. But I caused that suffering, and for causing that suffering, for causing that diminishment, I need to have an atonement. You need to bring an atonement for me every month because as if I've sinned. Now let's try and figure that all out. And the Medrash goes on and draws a conclusion from this. And if somebody who encroaches on another's territory with the permission of God, God caused it, nevertheless he becomes diminished, if somebody encroaches on somebody else's territory without God's permission, imagine what diminishment that causes. That's what the Medrash says. And what does it all mean? And why does God do it? And why the moon? Why does the moon? Why doesn't God make the sun smaller? The moon comes with a valid complaint, as the moon himself says. God set them up that they would encroach on one another, that the moon would encroach. And now we understand to an extent why it's the moon that gets made smaller rather than the sun. Because the moon is the one that encroaches in what sense? But it isn't really so. When you're talking about encroaching, it wasn't an intentional act. It's the sun and moon, they're programmed. These are not human beings. So if they're encroaching on each other's territory, it's because God programmed them that way. God could have moved the sun away. could have moved the moon away. He could have done it any way he wanted to. He chose to cause an encroachment. So it's not the moon's fault more than the sun's fault. What is this all about? Why are we told the story, and why does God diminish the size of the moon? Let us go back for a moment to the second day and the third day. The second day, we said, God created machlokes. God created the possibility of seeing things differently. He created gray areas. He created the colors of the rainbow, so to say, between black and white. He introduced the opportunity for disagreement. He introduced the opportunity for challenge, to challenge God himself. He built that into the Bereis. It was on the second day that God removed dogmatism from the Torah, because there's an opportunity now and an expectation, in fact, that a reasoning process sets in, and with the reasoning comes questioning, and with questioning come different approaches, and with different approaches come different views, and with different views come conflict. So God builds conflict in order to facilitate flexibility and fluidity, because unfortunately it's one or the other. You either have an absolutely dogmatic, inflexible dictatorship, autocracy, where everybody accepts one person's view and that's it, they don't question it, and then you can have peace. Then there's no conflict, but there's no flexibility. Nothing ever changes, nothing ever adapts, everything remains inflexible. Or you allow for flexibility, but allowing for flexibility means there's change, and for change there's going to be questioning, and for questioning there's going to be conflict. So God chooses to allow conflict for the sake of fluidity, for the sake of change and flexibility, so not to have anything that is too dogmatic. And he does that on the second day. And we explain, in fact, that the second, when you've got one point leaves it completely open as to which direction you're going to go into. You put a big white sheet of paper, and you put a point on the paper. From that point, you could go in any direction. Everything's open. When you put your second point, you're actually determining a direction. And if there's 3 points, then you've got a complete direction. In other words, if you've got 2 points and you're going to put a third one somewhere in between, you don't have much choice as to where to put that. You may have a question as to where you put it in the length, but you don't have a question as to on what lateral level to put it at. It has to be between those 2 points. So when you've got two, you have duality. Where you have duality, you have the tensions inherent in duality. Duality does not always mean harmony. Sometimes duality brings harmony, and sometimes duality brings disharmony. And for there to be change, duality has to bring disharmony. As long as duality is bringing harmony, there's no change. It's only when there's a disharmony that there's change. The third becomes critical, because in the third is the resolution of conflict. In two, there can be no resolution. In one, there is no conflict. In two, there is no resolution. Because if two disagree with each other, how are they going to resolve it? There needs to be a third something, either a third person to cast a casting vote, or a third authority, that's an objective framework that you can refer to. But if there are only two ideas in the world, and those ideas differ one from the other, and there is nobody else with any other idea, there is no way that those two ideas can possibly be resolved. You need a third dimension to resolve conflict between two dimensions. And we have that in halacha, we have that a lot. We say it every morning. Ad shiyovoy hakotuv hashlishi biyachriya beinahem. But very often in the Torah you've got two conflicting ideas, and we search for a third idea that supports one of the two, so that we have a sense as to how to resolve the conflict between the two. In the third one, we find resolution. So we should expect that in the third day, there was resolution to conflict. If conflict was created on the first day, and that's why it doesn't, on the second day, and that's why it doesn't say ketov, you remember? Second day, no ketov. Why? Because it's natural that in the creation of challenge and evolution, there will also be the creation of conflict. And with conflict comes machlokes and destructiveness and all sorts of terrible things that happen. And God sees that that's inevitable. Either I've got to have an inflexible world where there is no conflict, or I've got to have a fluid world in which there will be conflict. But the conflict will have negative consequences, so no ketov on Tuesday, on Monday. Yom Sheni, no ketov. When do we get the ketov? On the third day. what would seem to be the case is we would expect then that on the third day is the resolution to the conflict that he created on the second day. We should be taught on the third day how to resolve the conflict that he created on the second day. And that's why there's a double ketov on the third day. There's a ketov for the day itself, and there's a ketov because he completes what he started on the second day. He gives us the methodology to resolve conflict. But we learned the third day, didn't we? We studied. Did we find method of resolving conflict? We didn't. So either our thesis is wrong, that the third day doesn't contain resolution, or we missed something. And what do you think is more likely? Our thesis is wrong, or that we missed something? We missed. The thesis is right. It has to be right. We missed something. There's something in the third day that bears within it the art of conflict resolution. Conflict is inevitable. There is a way to resolve it. And in the fourth day, God teaches us what was created on the third day that teaches the resolution. And he takes us through. Second day creates. First day, there's no conflict. It's one. Second day, there's conflict. Oh no, what do I do with conflict? Third day is the resolution, but I can't see the resolution. Sometimes you need to go to the fourth day and take a look back, and you'll see the resolution yesterday. You don't always understand the resolution at the time that you're in the resolution. Sometimes you need to go beyond the resolution, and you learn something in the beyond that gives you an insight into what came before, in which you see the resolution. So what is there on the fourth day that teaches us what the resolution was on the third day? Listen to this medrash. There was a man in the Torah in Parshas Noach called Yoktan. Not a very significant figure. Other than that, he was the son of Aver. Aver was quite a well-known figure. Aver was a great-grandson of Shem. Shem was the son of Noach. So Aver was a great-great-grandson of Noach. And Aver had a child called Yoktan. He had two children. One was called Peleg, and one was called Yoktan. Interesting name. Peleg means what? Plukta, which means division. Machlokes. And in fact, at the end of his life was the Tower of Babel. And Shem called him... Aver called him Peleg because prophetically Aver saw the coming of the building of the Tower of Babel. And he knew it would be in this son's lifetime. But the end of this son's lifetime is the first major division in the world. There were little arguments before, but the Tower of Babel was the first time that the world really separated into different cultures, into different language groups, people who couldn't communicate with each other. So the translation of that machlokes, which God created on the second day, comes to full reality with the Tower of Babel. In Peleg is the... whether Peleg was involved in it or not, we don't know very much about Peleg. But Peleg is mentioned, his name is Peleg. His brother's name is Yoktan. Yoktan comes from the word katan, small. Says the Medrash. Om Rabbi Yachel, lama nikra shmo Yoktan? Why was his name Yoktan? Shehoyo maktin es asoko. Because he used to diminish his achievements. Instead of making them sound great, he would always make his achievements sound less than they really were. He did the opposite of good marketing. Whenever he spoke about his achievements, he spoke about them in less glory than they deserved. Me Zocho, what did he get? Zocho lahamid 13 mishpachos gedolim. 13 great families emanated from Yoktan, and they're listed in the Torah. From Peleg, nobody's mentioned. Whether he didn't have any children or they weren't worthy of mention, we don't know. But in Peleg's case, no children are mentioned. In Yoktan's case, 13 families are mentioned. And now the Medrash makes a Kal V'chomer. Uma im Yoktan al yedei shehoyo matines asokov kach. Godol shu matines asokov alachas kama v'kama. If the younger brother, who is smaller by definition, is the junior one, makes his achievement small, and he's so rewarded, imagine what the reward there is if the older brother makes his achievement small. That's a strange kal v'chomer, isn't it? It shouldn't be that way around at all. Why should be a Kal Vachomer? The younger one makes him small because he's younger, because he's smaller, he's more junior. Maybe the older one, the more senior one, the more accomplished one, maybe is entitled to make them bigger. What is the Kal Vachomer? What is the connection? How can you say because a small person who makes himself small is so rewarded, a big person who makes himself small is rewarded even more? And the Midrash goes on to give other examples like that. When Jacob blesses his grandchildren Ephraim and Manasseh, Ephraim was the younger one and Manasseh the older one, but we mention Ephraim first because he switched his arms around. He put his right hand on Ephraim and he put his left hand on Manasseh. He switched them around, and we're told that Ephraim was the younger one. And the Medrash asks Rabbi Chunya, don't we know that Ephraim was the youngest one? We were told that. But it comes to teach us. Elamahu ha'seisho yom matzir es asochot. He too made himself younger. He made himself junior to his older brother, although he was greater. So he was very careful to diminish his accomplishments in the light of his older brother, not to eclipse his older brother. What was the result? He got the Bechorah. He was treated as the firstborn. Yaakov switches them around and makes him the firstborn. And again, Kal Vachomer. If the younger brother, by diminishing his accomplishments, gets the Bechorah, he gets the merit of the firstborn. Imagine if the older brother would make himself smaller, how much he would get. What is the Medrash saying? There's a very important Zohar. Zohar is the beginning of Chaye Sorah. It's an interesting thing. The way we write, if you look at the Ksuba, look at your own Ksubas, you'll see it. The way we write the Hebrew year, and it comes from Chaye Sorah, from Parashat Chaye Sorah, where it records Sorah's life, how long she lived. It says she lived for 100 years and 7 years and 20. Okay. And it says Mea Shono Besheva Shonim. 100 year and 7 years. It says the Medrash the following. This is the Mizrah the following. Zachor Iyu, fortunate is the man, Man de Aziz Garambe Bahai Alma, who diminishes himself in this world. Kama ihu rav ala b'ha'u alma. How much greater is he in the world to come? Bachi posach rav masif tam. The Rosh Yeshiva, the head of the academy, taught the following. Man de ihu zoyin, ihu rav. One who is small is in fact large. One who is small is in fact great. Man de ihu rav, ihu zoyin. One who is large is in fact small. The one who positions himself as great is in fact small. One who positions himself as small is in fact great. And he learns it out from the way it says with the years of Chaye Sorah, the years of Sorah lived. Mayo the Yuchushman Rav, 100, that's a big number. So it's a Shona, year. The smallest it could do when it describes the big 100, it uses the singular. Sheva, when it's a 7, the Iyu Chushpen Zoi, which is a small number. Aski Leva, Rabi Leva, the Torah makes big. It expands it, it says Shonim, years. 100 years, 7 years. So the Torah wants to teach us that Man de Azil Garme Baha Alma Kama Yu Rav Le Yeloi Laha Alma. The more a person diminishes himself in this world, the greater he is in the world to come. And what's that all about? Are we supposed to be falsely modest? Are we supposed to hide away? Are we supposed to pretend we didn't accomplish what we did? What does this all mean? Well, we wouldn't understand it if it wasn't for the third day of creation. This means compress yourself. It doesn't mean contract yourself. It means compress yourself. When you compress yourself, what you've got is dense. When you expand yourself, you take up a whole lot of space that you're lightweight. If something is very, we know what happens if you can have the same amount of mass, if it takes up an enormous amount of space, it floats more easily. And if you expand it enough, it will even float in the air. If you contract it, if you took a Boeing 747 and you contracted it even just a little bit, if you pushed it together just a little bit, it would fall right out of the air. because it's designed only at that level of density to be able to fly. But if you make it more dense than that, if you put too much of a load in it, if there's anything you do to damage its density beyond what it's meant to be able to be, it will fall out of the sky. So you can have two items. In other words, there's a measure apart from size. The measure of density is the measure of the relationship of size to content. Is that right? We're talking about the volume of the actual material. So you could have 100 pounds of mass. You could have 100 pounds of mass that occupies an enormous volume, and you can have 100 pounds of mass that occupies a small volume. And you might say there's no difference between the two. But there's an enormous difference between the two. The one sinks and the one floats. But it's the same material. What's the difference? The difference is density. Just as in physics, density impacts on the weightiness of something, so in human beings, density determines weightiness. A person's weightiness is not a function of how much matter he's got. It's a function of the relationship between how much matter he's got and how much space it occupies. If a person occupies a big space because there's a lot of matter and it's dense and it's big, that's godless, that's greatness. If a person occupies a whole lot of space but he's empty, that's Zoya. That's a person who makes himself big, but in God's eyes it's more, because when God looks at him, God compacts him to what he really is. And he's really nothing. Absolutely nothing. And the Zohar teaches us how to look at people. Don't look at the volume. Look at the relationship of the volume to the density. Look at the density of the person. That's what's important. Because you could take a very small piece of matter. Remember what they said? Compact the universe and you'll have it the size of a tennis ball. That's the relationship. So you might look at the universe and say, wow, that's big. And you could look at a tennis ball and say that's tiny and irrelevant. But they're the same. What you've got to look at is the amount of matter. You've got to take density into account, not just volume. And in this world, man's eye measures volume. We measure size. We can't measure density. You need an instrument to measure density. Archimedes discovered how to measure density, but it was a whole ma'arach. He jumped out of his bath, he was so excited. Because until then, the human being didn't know how to measure density. You need seichel to measure density, because density is a spiritual concept. Density is an intellectual concept. It's not a measure. It's not something you can see. So what Archimedes did in discovering that was amazing. He was right to jump out of the bath, because he bridged, for the first time in that area, he bridged what the human eye could see with what God could see. He found a way of measuring density, being able to look beyond the appearance and take two things that look the same size, and with his eyes, he was able to see that although they look the same size, they're not the same size. One is weighty and one is not weighty, because the densities are different. And the Zohar says, when God looks at people, and that's how we need to look at people, God looks at the density, the substance. What's really there? And that's very, very hard. You've got to be an Archimedes in people, as he was in physics. You've got to be able to see right through the surface and right through all the nonsense and all the packaging, and throw all that out and compress it into a little bundle and look at the person and say, that's what he really is. And my goodness, when you start that, you're in for the shock of your life, because nobody will ever look the same to you again. The only thing I would ask you to do is, when you start this process, start looking at yourself, because they are the biggest surprises. The areas that occupy a lot of space are not necessarily very dense, and you will find in your soul some very precious places that you don't allow to occupy much space. But they are the dense places. They might be the real place that you've just crammed into a little corner because the world doesn't value it. But you've got to establish your value using Archimedes' principles, not using your eyes alone. The fool sees things only in terms of the size and the volume. It's you need to be the physicist to understand the nature of material, to be able to see below that and to look at the density, to look at the specific gravity of the person. And we don't differ that much from one another in volume. We all like to occupy as much volume as we can. We all puff ourselves up pretty much as we can. And our volume is not that different. How does Archimedes work out how you tell the difference between two pieces of material that look identical? How do you tell if a king's crown has been forged? How do you tell if it's a fake? What does specific gravity do? It removes the possibility of fake. It teaches you how to detect fake. And it's exactly the same with people. Being able to perceive the specific gravity of a person differentiates. Because no two people have the same specific gravity. That's where people are differentiated. And until we start looking at people in terms of their density, of their specific gravity, everybody looks much the same. And we get taken in with it, with all the blown up hot air. Until we look at the specific gravity and we see who's real and who isn't. Who really delivers and who just talks about delivering. As the Mishnah says, is an emor me'atzei aseh harbeh, says a lot, but says a little, but does a lot. That's substance. That's real. When you're with a person, talk, and nothing gets done. Always over-talk and under-deliver. That's a lot of space, little density. And the Torah, God has no time for that. God doesn't value that. So that's the Zohar tells us. Now, with that in mind, we can understand our Medrash. If Yoktan, who's the smaller brother, compresses himself, he's small to start with, but he still says, I want to compress more. How much more so does a big person have to compress? Because the bigger you are, the more you should compress, not the less you should compress. So make sure that the bigness is not blown up volume, that it's real. Small person, if you're very small to start with, if you're a tennis ball to start with, how much smaller are you going to get? Not a big deal. But if you're a universe, you better see whether you can contract yourself to the size of a tennis ball to see what you really are. So then the Kal Vachomer makes sense. The bigger you are, if you get a reward, if a small person gets a reward for making himself small, how much more so a big person? Now what's that got to do with resolving conflict? So this concept of compression we learned on the third day. God created the capacity to take a large amount of matter and compress it so that it could be contained in a container smaller than it. That's really what compression means. Make it so dense that you can put yourself in smaller packages. And then there's real density. Then when you open the package, there's excitement. You'll find inside the package more than you've got on the outside of the package. What's that got to do with the resolution of conflict? Now we learn on the fourth day. If you've learned the principles of compression, you've learned the principles of reducing yourself to your essential specific gravity and seeing yourself and others that way, then we have a way of dealing with machlokes. Because where does machlokes usually occur? Machlokes occurs where this one, Boli Chum Chavero, where he's come into the territory of his friend. What is that territory? It's not the specific gravity. If everybody reduced themselves to their true density, there wouldn't be those overlaps. The reason that we tend to overlap is because we expand ourselves beyond where we're meant to be. Beyond the limits of where we're meant to be. And finding that balance between expanding ourselves to our full potential and expanding ourselves into somebody else's area is the crucial part that most of the Choshen Mishpat, most of Jewish business law deals with exactly that. How do I define how far my territory goes? How do I define how far it is legitimate for me to expand myself, to expand my business, to expand my ideas, to expand what I say, to expand what I write? How far can I go? The answer is you can go as far as you want until the point you're eclipsing somebody else. When you're overlapping somebody else who was there before you, that far you cannot go. You're stealing. You're taking something that isn't yours. And you're creating the impression, as we discussed on Sukkot, take a stolen lulav. Why are you taking a stolen lulav? Because you want everybody to see that you've got a lulav, but it isn't a lulav. But it looks like a lulav. That's expansion. It isn't a lulav, it's a piece of stolen property. It belongs in a police station. Take it there, that's where it belongs. It's stolen, it's stolen goods. It's not a lulav. What is this? This is stolen goods. That's how the halacha would define it. Not this is a lulav. So why would a person steal it? If you know, and we're talking about people who've learned, because otherwise who else would know that halacha? So we're talking about somebody who knows the law, and yet he goes to steal a lulav. Why does he go and do it? There can only be one reason. He wants the other people in shul to see that he's got a lulav. And even though it's not a real lulav, but it looks like a lulav. So what's he involved in? He's involved in appearance. He's not involved in density. He's not involved in the real thing. Because if you contract that lulav to what it really is, it's a piece of vegetation that has been stolen. That's what that is. Nothing more than that. You take a lulav that you yourself have bought and you've invested thought into and you've paid for it and you've acquired it. that's a piece of vegetation that it expanded into a lulav, into an esrog, into a new concept. It's truly a bigger concept. So sometimes you've got something that looks big, which is really very small, and sometimes you've got something that looks small, but is really much bigger, and deserves to be much bigger. And so when we expand ourselves to a point that we encroach on somebody else's territory, then we are involved in appearance rather than reality. And you say, yeah, a lulav and esrog, who would be so stupid as to steal a lulav and esrog when it doesn't even count as a mitzvah? Why would you do it? In fact, we do it all the time. We steal one another's glory, we steal one another's ideas, we steal one another's customers and clients, we steal one another's opportunities. What are we doing? Are we going to get any kind of recognition for that? Yes, in the human world, we will. Because people won't see behind us. They don't look at the specific gravity, they just look at the volume. And the more we've stolen, the more volume we occupy. But in God's eyes, stolen goods or stolen time or stolen ideas don't occupy any space at all. It's nothing. Absolutely nothing. It's negative. Negative energy. It's not possible.
So let us move into the area of the resolving of conflict once again. Now I come to an area where somebody else is bigger than me. What do I do? And it's an area that I want to participate. It's an area where now there's a clash of interest. It's not an area which is alien to me. It's not an area which is foreign to me. We're competing for the same territory. And he's there already. And he's doing well already. So now I either withdraw and contract, or what do I do exactly? Says God to the moon, contract yourself. That's the point, that you need to use the principle of contraction. Pull back. But we need to go one step further in understanding the nature of this contraction. I've quoted to you the Gemara about the story with the moon, and I've quoted to you the Medrash about the story with the moon. The Zohar, which we learned in the late issue some months ago, tells the same story again with a slightly different angle, but a very important angle. Same thing, the moon is not satisfied, comes to God as far as the sun is concerned, feels embarrassed, feels outshone by the sun, and God tells the moon to withdraw itself, to contract itself, and it does so. But what the Medrash does is it relates it to a verse in Shir HaShirim, in the Song of Songs, where it talks about, there in the Song of Songs says, where can I pasture? Can I go to eat? Can I go to feed myself? Echot tarbitz batzoharayim. Where will I eat in the midday? If a lamb is talking, or a shepherd is talking about his lambs, where will I feed my flock in the heat of the midday? Which is the Zohar says is the moon saying to the sun, or to God about the sun, how can I be making any worthwhile contribution with the full light of the sun? But so I am at midday. What is my value with the sun there? And God answers and says, Tzi'ilach be'ikvei hatzoin, follow the footsteps of the flock. Yeah, you can. If you get lost in the story in Shir HaShirim at that point, is that the Jewish people saying to God, what happens if we get lost? What happens if we don't know our way? Our future, our destiny is linked to morality, to doing the right thing. What happens if we don't know what the right thing is to do? Says God, don't worry, go and follow the footsteps of the flock. In other words, seek out your tradition, find your origins, get back to your roots, to your principles, to your essence. See what Avram used to do, see what Yitzchak used to do, see what Yaakov used to do. Go back to your originators and see how they walked, and walk in their footsteps. You always find your way back if you do that. And that's the verse that the Zohar says God uses with the moon. And says, good, you can't compete against the sun in the daylight. He's too powerful for you. Follow Chibi Ikvei Atzon. And the Zohar explains that originally the moon was a source of light itself. And that's what it means, the two big lights. They were both generators of light. Nowadays, of course, the moon is a reflector of light. But there was a time when the moon was gas, was a burning gas as well. And so they were both generating light. And the moon said, two kings can't share the same crown, but we've got to separate responsibilities. And at that point, God diminishes the moon. What does that mean? God explains to the moon, you're right, moon, you can't both generate original light to the same point. That you can't do. If you want to be a generator, you can generate academically. It won't reach Earth. The Zohar implies that when the moon was generating its own light, it wasn't visible to Earth. It was out there. It was like there are many millions of stars out there that we don't see, that we've never seen, that we might never see. Maybe one day we will. So the moon was a star that we couldn't see. And the moon objected to that. The moon said, I want to have impact on the Earth. I want to influence the Earth. I want to be doing something worthwhile. That was the moon's statement. In saying, I want to compete with the sun, what the moon was saying, I also want to give my light onto the Earth. It says, God, if you want that, you have to reflect. You can't be the generator of light. You can't be the source of light. Now what's interesting is that the linkage of this to Shir HaShirim is important, because when we learned Shir HaShirim, when we learned the Song of Songs with the ladies and we started working through it, the thesis was that Shir HaShirim simultaneously talks about the Jewish people's relationship to God and a woman's relationship to her husband. And that's the image right through the book. So each image, each little snapshot of relationship that Shir HaShirim spoke about, we studied from the context of what does this say about the similarity between the relationship of Israel to God and man to woman to man. And here, how does this work over here? God is saying to the Jewish people, your function is not to create new ideas. Your function is to reflect the ideas that already exist, and to reflect them in a way that makes them easy and pleasant and able to be integrated and adaptable. The sun doesn't change. The sun is in its full glory, and every day it burns, and it burns a full sun. There's no half sun and quarter sun and new sun and nothing like that. The sun just keeps going. The moon changes. Every night it's different. Every night it rises in a different position and sets in a different position. It's a different size. It gives a different amount of light. There's change. So the moon's role is to take the sun, or the light of the sun, and modify it for nighttime, and introduce fluctuations, and introduce romanticism, and to reduce subtlety and softness, and all sorts of elements that the sun is too powerful to do. That's what the moon does. So the role of the Jewish people is to take God's ideas and reflect them, and communicate them, and change them and adapt them in a way that doesn't change their essence, but makes them able to be integrated in each generation, and applies them heavily when one part needs to be emphasized, and changes the emphasis when another part needs to be emphasized. That's the role of the Jewish people in evolving Jewish law. We're not creating new law. We're not creating new halachic concepts. That all exists before, and that's part of the constant juggle of Jewish legal thinking, is at what point, how far can I go without changing the essence? I must be sure that I'm reflecting the sun at all times. The way I reflect it today is different from the way I reflected it yesterday. The way this authority reflects it is different to the way that authority reflects it. The timing at which I reflect it is different. But I must be sure that I'm reflecting the sun at all times. And Talmudic reasoning teaches us how to walk that balancing line, how to retain authenticity and at the same time to modify and to adapt to make sure that it can be integrated into the world. That what we're reflecting is the sun, is God's light, not our own light. That's our role. And that's why the Zohar equates us to the moon. You Jewish people want to have impact in the world, that's fine, but your way of having impact is to reflect God's word, not to create new words. You want to create new words, the non-Jews can do that. You want a New Testament, the Christians can do that. You want another Bible, the Buddhists can make their thing, and the Muslims can make. They can all make new religions. That's not your role. New philosophies, and the existentialists can make a new one, and this one can make a new one, and they'll undo that one and go back to another one. All of that they can do, but that's not your role. Your role is to stay constant. One philosophy, one value system, one religion that never changes in its essence, but always changes in the way it's adapted, in the way it's applied, in the way it's communicated, in the way it's taught. That's the role of the moon, and that's the role of the Jewish people. What about man-woman? Husband-wife. Here we're not talking about husband-wife in terms of their independent professional status and capabilities. Today women are highly educated, highly sophisticated, and in most places where they enter fields that men have traditionally held, they do better than men have ever done before. So that's not the area we're talking about. We're talking about specifically in their relationship to one another. They can compete with one another. A woman can choose to compete with her husband. And you know what? The chances are that if a couple are well matched and a woman chooses to compete with her husband, she will win. She's more gifted, more talented, more intuitive, more flexible, in many ways brighter. The chances are that a man and woman who are well matched, if she chooses to compete with him, she will win. But in the process, she will lose her husband. She'll have a doormat. She'll have a grump. She'll have a companion at times. She'll have somebody to pay her bills. She'll have somebody to talk to. But she will not have a husband. She would have destroyed that. And that's her option. That's her choice. And that's not just in the man-woman relationship. That's in the male-female relationship. And the male-female relationship you can have in all sorts of situations. You can have it between two men in business situations. You can have it between two men. Take a president and a vice president candidate. A vice president can choose to outshine the president. In this election, that's not very difficult. He can choose. He can choose to compete with the president and to outshine him. And he might well succeed. But he will lose a president. He won't gain a vice president. He might lose his position, or the president loses his status. Nothing is gained, only lost. Because the relationship is a male-female relationship. The relationship is, if you want to have impact as part of that team, and again I emphasize, I'm not talking about a woman's impact in her own area. A woman in her own area is a man, in terms of the male-female issue. There's no difference. But we're talking about the man-woman relationship, and whether it's two women in a work environment, or it's two men in a work environment, or it's a husband and wife in a marital relationship, or it's a teacher and a student, whoever it is and whatever it is, when that relationship exists, there needs to be a sun and there needs to be a moon. If they're two suns, then they're two different businesses. If they're two suns, it's two families. If there's two sons, it's two political parties, two presidents, not a president and a vice president. If it's a president and a vice president, it's one sun, one moon. And then you have a team that is able to reflect in all situations, that covers everything. You have a husband and a wife, one team, a sun and a moon. And that works when the husband is able to generate and when the wife is able to reflect. And that means she can take his ideas and his thinking. We're talking about an ideal world, and you'll begin to understand. We don't have time to get into detail, but perhaps we'll develop it next week. What goes wrong so often in relationships? Either the moon eclipses the sun because the moon decides she wants to compete, or the moon eclipses the sun because the sun can't give much. But no matter how she tries to diminish herself, there comes a point. You diminish yourself to your essence and you still can't see the sun. That's not the moon's fault. That's because the sun just isn't the sun. So whatever the cause, we'll go into that, but whatever the cause is, in a situation where you've got a sun, a man, or the male part, the male party in the relationship that is generating the ideas, that is generating the thinking, that is fixing the direction with discussion and with debate, and with, we're not talking about a person just goes off on his own and does what he needs to do, but he is able to generate, to stimulate, to set off a thinking process. And she is able to take that, whoever the she is, whether it's a he or a she, the she in the relationship can take that and can modify it and can apply it and can change it and can make it look different and can teach it to this child in that way, and to that child in that way, and to this situation in this way, and to that situation in that way. But it's always authentic. Whenever you see her, you can detect the authenticity of his philosophy communicated and taught and lived in her unique way. Then you've got one team. Then you've got one family. Then you've got one unit. And that's how conflict has to be resolved. When two people who both exceptional find themselves overlapping, where one starts eclipsing the other, what did Yoktan do? I'm the younger brother. Let me contract myself. Not contract and make me smaller, just more dense. I'm not losing anything of myself. I'm just ensuring that the place I occupy doesn't obliterate him, that it doesn't diminish him. That's all I'm doing. So I'm more dense. The moon is more dense than the sun, in a sense, isn't it? The moon is a solid object. The sun is gas. So the moon, although it's giving less light, there's much more substance in the moon. Smaller, but there's more substance. It's dense, it's contracted, it's compressed. And that is that role of the feminine partnership, part of the partnership, where she is able to reduce herself to her to a more dense being, a more real being, in order not to diminish the ego of the male in the partnership. And she's the one who does that. And so it is in all situations of machlokes, of such potential conflict. There are all sorts of different conflicts. But the conflict of competitiveness, where two people are competing for the same space, and they want to work as a team. If they want to fight, if they want to work as competitors, that's a different story. But where they want to collaborate, where they want to form a union, where they want an alliance, there better be at least one of the parties that knows how to contract to his or her essence, enabling the other one to dominate that particular space. And she in turn can dominate a different space. That's not that crucial. But that is the lesson that God teaches us. So when God says, bring a sin offering for me, what we're going to have to discuss is, so what was wrong? If God wants the world to operate that way, and the purpose of setting it up that way was to teach us that, and God sets it up in that particular way, what is God bringing a sin offering for thousands of years thereafter, almost apologizing for having diminished the moon? This is the way he set up the world. This is the way he wants the world to operate. What does it mean, God sinned? How can God sin? These are ideas that we'll have to develop a little bit further when we take this fourth day to its conclusion next week, next Monday night. Thank you.